Hi, I'm Yudi Bunyamin, and welcome to The Neumann Talk, a podcast where I meet past winners of the Australian Mathematical Society's B.H. Neumann Prize to learn about their journeys through the world of mathematics. This episode's guest is Dr. Maureen Edwards, who has spent her entire academic life at the University of Wollongong. She completed a Bachelor of Mathematics with honors there before continuing with a PhD. Since then, she's had an illustrious academic career. Maureen has published numerous papers in applied mathematics. She has also had extensive experience in teaching university mathematics, spanning over 25 years. In 2011, she won the UOW Vice Chancellor's Award for outstanding contributions to teaching and learning. Currently, Maureen is the head of the School of Mathematics and Applied Statistics at the University of Wollongong. Maureen won the B.H. Neumann Prize in 1993 while she was a PhD student at the University of Wollongong, working under the supervision of Philip Broadbridge. So what do you remember of your Neumann Prize talk, Maureen?
Well, it was quite a long time ago, and I'm starting my second year of my PhD, and all I can really remember is probably being quite nervous because I was sort of an applied mathematician PhD, although my topic was somewhere between pure and applied, but the Australian Mathematical Society annual conference tended to be more pure mathematicians, so I probably was very nervous about being in such a mixed group of mathematicians.
Yeah, something I've heard multiple times is, you know, when I'm encouraging people to go to the Austin Mess meeting is, oh no, that's for pure maths people. Yeah. So I guess it was like that back then. It was more pure math dominated.
Look, it may not have been only pure math dominated, but that might have been my impression of it. That's not necessarily the same thing. And I know that it's a lot broader with respect to applied mathematics and education and special interest sort of sessions now. But at that time, I probably was a little overwhelmed, but that's probably true for every student presenting at a conference of any type, to be honest.
Yeah. And if you look at, say, the list of Neumann winners or, say, the list of Austin Mess Medal winners or the other prizes that are given out at the conference, there are quite a lot of people who you traditionally associate with applied mathematics. So, I mean, my personal opinion is definitely not true that, you know, you have a much better chance of winning the Neumann Prize if you work in pure. So just before we started this interview, Maureen, you showed me that you still have your slides from all the way back in 1993. I guess back then, Beamer wasn't a thing yet. You know, you just showed them to me and they're like transparencies, handwritten transparencies. How long does it take to prepare that? Or I mean, what's different about doing it that way from the way that we tend to do it now?
I guess constructing a talk, what you want to say doesn't change because you still have to draft it out and, you know, scaffold what you want to say and have enough of an introduction and some sort of information about your topic, but also have enough time to get to an interesting, you want to be able to sure you get to an interesting result at the end, but you need enough information along the way for people to know what you were doing. One of the things back then was because we used to, well, I did, and most people did, I think, write on their transparencies, is that if you made a mistake, it was really annoying because you had to rewrite the transparency, whereas at least now everything's done electronically. And by the way, we don't even use transparencies anymore. Like, they're projected, everything's quite different. But the preparation, you know, you needed to be really painstaking. Having said that, you would see back at that time very different types of presentations. And I remember being very shocked at seeing someone who was quite eminent or well-regarded basically having a photocopy of his paper onto transparencies and using that as his talk. And you're going, well, we can't read anything. And I was quite shocked that someone would do that. So, you know, going along to conferences really let you see the full sort of range of the way that people present and share their information. And you always learn better ways to do things at the same time.
So I know this was a long time ago, but why do you think you won?
That's a good question. I don't have a lot of memory of the actual meeting. I think at the time my topic, even though it sort of has applications, it's a sort of a pure math idea, analysis idea applied to areas of applied mathematics. But I think that there may have been people in the audience in that particular year that that research really resonated with as well. But apart from that, I can't say, and it, at the time that I was presenting, I wasn't thinking about the fact that there was a prize. That wasn't something that I was thinking, oh, I've got a chance at this. I was just there as a student, you know, presenting. And I think part of the reason I may have even been at that conference is I think that it was held in my hometown or in the town where I was studying, because if it had been somewhere else in Australia, it may have been that I wouldn't have even gone to that conference. So there was a little bit of happenstance that I was at that particular conference as well.
So it was hosted by your home institution?
It was hosted by the University of Wollongong, and it was held on campus, which the Australian Mathematical Society annual conferences are always at an institution, whereas the other conferences that I would typically go to for the ANSIAM, which is the Australian New Zealand Industrial and Applied Mathematics conferences, are always off campus. So they're always somewhere away from universities.
And I guess that's why it's particularly important for the conference to move around the country. Ultimately, the reality is that it costs much less to go to the conference if it's in your city, and therefore it gives more students an opportunity to go around. You mentioned something quite interesting there, which is that like your research might have resonated with the people in the audience at the time. Like when I gave my Neumann talk, you know, it was an equity talk, and that was the first time that there was an equity session. And so I do feel that there is a sense that, you know, the time was right. Right? There was a lot of attention on that session that year. Do you think that's like a big factor in winning the Neumann Prize or even just giving a good talk? It's like, it just happens that, you know, that's the time for your research.
I mean, obviously a good talk in any area is going to be highly competitive for that prize. But maybe at certain times, there are certain things that do resonate. And as you say, an equity talk, there's a lot more focus or emphasis on that now. And so more people are alert or open to that. And maybe that makes them more receptive to that type of talk as well. So I'd say a bit of both. But I mean, I've been to a number of conferences and I've seen lots of great student talks. And I don't know how they decide between them, to be honest, because sometimes, you know, how do you rank these different talks by different students in very different areas? And some of them, some talks really lend themselves naturally to very like public lecture type, everyone can understand it. And others are maybe quite technical but still very good. And I find it really hard to discern, well, which, where do you put them? How do you decide?
So what do you think is the secret? What's your advice to students who are preparing for talks at the AustMS conference or for any conference, really?
I think it's tricky because students, and not just students, academics in general, we all want to share what we're doing. And I think we want to put as much as we can into our talks. And especially for students, when I see honours students presenting, and you need to get enough information about the preparation that you've done to get to the final result that you want to talk about. And it's a question of trying to balance that so that the audience has enough knowledge about what you're doing. But you also want to get to the end to show them the great things that you've done. But I think sometimes you've got to realize that you can't let people know everything that you've done. It's just not possible. So you have to pick out a key thing and just aim for that and not lose them at the start. Sort of make sure that they have enough information along the way as well. And also just that whole engagement and, you know, if you've enjoyed the topic, then that comes across and people are more engaged with your talk as well, I think.
So you did your undergraduate studies at the University of Wollongong, and that was in mathematics. It wasn't like you took a generic science degree. I guess I should start by asking, what was the motivation behind that?
Maybe we can go back a little bit further than that. So I grew up in North Queensland and I loved mathematics at school, but I did well in sciences and I did a very kind of traditional science sort of year 11 and 12. And it was seemed automatic that I would go to university, and my closest university was James Cook University in Townsville. So I went there without a great deal of thought. I just went and started a Bachelor of Science, and mathematics was, you know, part of a major in a Bachelor of Science, and did some first year science subjects and mathematics. I have to say I was terribly unmotivated, and despite being a good student, I was someone that I'm sure all of the lecturers really wondered what I was doing, because I wasn't doing very much, and sort of scraped through my first year there and decided to defer, which really was a polite way of saying I was dropping out. And I left university because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I couldn't understand what I would do with the degree, or what people did at the end of a science degree, or what I would major in. I didn't have any focus on what was going to happen next. So I actually stopped, and then I worked for a few years, and I moved around in Queensland. And a lot of this is just happenstance. Came to Wollongong for completely sort of personal reasons, like with a partner, and was looking for work, and went, well, there's a university here. I could go back to uni. And so I was sort of getting to my mid-20s, and I didn't really think about what am I going to do at the end of the degree, because it didn't seem to matter so much. I'd been working, and I went, this is a bit not challenging, and went, I'm going to go back to uni. I'm going to enrol in a Bachelor of Mathematics, which Wollongong University offers, so I could do a mathematics degree rather than a science degree. And it was kind of an act of faith, but I wasn't worried about what was going to happen at the end. I just knew that I really enjoyed doing mathematics, and I was going to go back and have this second opportunity to do this degree, and then I would just wait and see what happened. And it was a great school of mathematics, and they were very encouraging. I came back in as a mature age student, sort of mature, but, you know, older than first years anyway, and I just loved it. I just loved the learning, and I was totally disinterested in worrying about what would happen at the end. I just wasn't giving it a thought. I was just totally immersed in doing mathematics, as much mathematics as I could, with some really great students around me and really supportive lecturers and academics. So it was really good. I could never have imagined when I dropped out of uni originally that I would come back and do a Bachelor of Mathematics and then do an honours degree, and then I don't even know if I knew what a PhD was when I was at James Cook Uni. You know, people didn't talk about those sorts of things. I could never have imagined that I'd come back to uni and then I'd be enrolling in a PhD in applied mathematics. It was never in my plan. So sometimes when you're 18 and you don't know what you want to do, it's kind of okay to not know. It still can work out okay.
Yeah, because that's less common these days. I find that, say, when I look at all of our undergrads, they all know what they want to do at the end, or they think they know what they want to do at the end, even though that's 99% of the time not what actually happens.
The undergrads I see, some I think have quite a clear idea of what they want to do, but I do see students who just aren't really sure, but in mathematics degrees, because they really like mathematics. So I hopefully that's enough to see them through their, you know, keep them motivated through their degree to move on to the next phase.
So I guess at some point in your time at Wollongong as a student, you grew an affinity towards what you do now, or maybe more towards applied maths. Like, when did that happen and how did it happen?
I think when I was doing the Bachelor of Mathematics, you know, you do a range of subjects. And in the degree, I would have had room for electives, but I think really once I got to second and third year, I never put in the electives. Or the electives that I put in were other mathematics subjects. So in my second year and in my third year, I was still very much across sort of pure and applied mathematics. I didn't have a strong preference. And I think when I went into my honours year, I thought, well, I can maybe do a bit more sampling of some pure mathematics in my honours year. But I think that we had a range of subjects and we had professors offering applied mathematics topics that they were all seemed very compelling. So then I suppose I just kept gravitating towards that area. And I was also very lucky in my honours year that there were three or four other students who were doing exactly the same honours subjects as me, and two of them were really good friends. So we had this really good support network. I had a really strong cohort around me, And I think that also really helped at the time. And then I suppose I just kept gravitating more towards applied mathematics. And then there was less space for the sort of the pure mathematics. And it wasn't necessarily a really conscious decision. It just sort of evolved that way.
You mentioned that you came back to mathematics a bit later in life, or later than a fresh out of high school first year student. What do you think are the advantages and disadvantages of that?
I think the advantages are that you make a very conscious choice to come back to uni. So you're not drifting into uni, or you're making a definite choice to be not working or working less so that you can study full time. So there's a level of commitment there that you're making. I guess the disadvantages are that maybe it's less fresh. And I remember doing a lot of revision in the summer before I came back to uni because I really felt, well, I haven't done, any calculus or lots of things for about 4 years and maybe 4 or 5 years. But to be honest, actually, once you got started, it was all came back very quickly. And I think also one of the things that I did, and maybe not everyone would have done this, but I could have had some advanced standing from my earlier studies, and I decided not to, and I repeated first year calculus subjects, which I think was absolutely the best thing to do. I mean, I could have jumped straight into some second year subjects, but I think that would have been a big mistake. And so I went into those first year subjects, and I came out of first year with, really, really strong fundamental knowledge, ready to go into second year again. So that was a good choice. But the downsides are, if you don't go straight out of uni, sometimes maybe you won't go back. And if I hadn't have come to Wollongong, maybe this would never have happened. So that, that's just because I was making different choices and I was part of a couple. And so we moved based on, decisions, not just mine. So that was just luck in a way that we ended up in Wollongong. And it was just the right place at the right time.
So maybe now is a good time to ask you about your research, like what it actually is. And the way that I like to pose this question is, if I were at the pub speaking to someone completely random and they asked me, what's Maureen's research about? Like, what does she do? Like, what do you want me to tell them?
So I'm an applied mathematician, and one of the main things that I've done throughout my academic career is use a very particular area of mathematics to try to find solutions to real-world problems. And the sorts of real-world problems that we look at are diffusion type problems. And the way I like to just explain in my first year lectures when I teach differential equations, in my first differential equations lecture, I'm sure none of the students appreciate it, but I like it. And I say, I did my PhD on diffusion convection equations, and I write up a partial differential equation, and they just look horrified because they're going, are we going to be examined on this? They're going, no. And then I say, this is a model of looking at how fluid flows in a porous media. And one of those terms sort of represents diffusion, which is a smoothing type of action. And the other term is sort of the effects of gravity. And then I say to them, if you take a biscuit and you put it into a cup of tea, because the biscuit's dry, it's drawing the fluid up into the biscuit. And that's the effects of diffusion, which are very strong compared to gravity because the biscuit's dry. And so that's a really domestic example of sort of a diffusion problem. And the other thing I talk to them about is, if you take a texture and you put it on a piece of very coarse paper and you hold the texture there, then the ink will spread out through the paper and it pretty much spreads out as a circle. I mean, the paper's not exactly the same all the way through, but it pretty much spreads out as a circle, and that's what diffusion is doing. It's always sort of has this sort of smooth boundary, and it's trying to smooth things out. And so that's one of the things that I say to my students, or if I talk to school students at sort of mathematics events, to give them, I mean, they can't see the mathematics behind it, but they can appreciate that you're trying to model something that they can observe in real life.
Right at the end there, you said they can't see the mathematics in that. And maybe it's easier for me to see the mathematics in that because I've done an undergraduate in mathematics. But I mean, one of the things that I've learned through doing outreach is that there's always this danger of if you talk about, say, mathematics for a particular application, then there's this danger of the audience interpreting this as more about, say, if you talk about mathematics as an application for like biology, then people think, oh, you just do biology. Like, how would you elaborate on your description of the research that you did to sort of make the mathematics stand out a bit more?
I guess what we would be saying is, as an applied mathematician, you can look at all sorts of different problems and you're trying to model something physical, but often the sort of mathematics behind it or the techniques you use are very similar, but then you're sort of using those to apply to different real-world problems. When I talk to students in the Illawarra, because we have the steelworks here, you know, you talk to them and say, well, diffusion also can be about heat diffusing, and that's a really big thing at the steelworks here, because that's what that whole operation is about. It's about melting and casting, doing continuous casting of steel slabs. And then, you know, there's some incredibly deep mathematics in that industrial process. I'm not sure if I've quite answered your question. I mean, the other thing that I've done in some outreach sorts of things is try to, I guess when we do outreach, we're trying to pick something that students can see that they understand the ideas behind so that they can have a hook into the mathematics, or you can use it to motivate the mathematics. But even looking at simple things like simple differential equations that you're looking at, a population model, and talking about, you know, why this population model is bad because it's got the population going to infinity, and is that what we really observe? Or, and even those maybe year 12 students don't understand or haven't really done much with differential equations, but talking about steady state solutions and the fact that you can find steady state solutions and how you can investigate the mathematics behind a problem, even if you don't know how to actually find the solution, but you can say things about the behavior of the solution. And you know, and does it make sense? Like, one of the things I'm always trying to say to students is, you know, there should be a common sense rule here. Does what you've just done or the solution that you're getting, do you think it makes sense given the problem that you're trying to solve? Like, don't just say, oh, well, I've got a solution, but does it look reasonable? Was it what I was expecting?
For example, when I talk to pure mathematicians, or people, you know, work in very pure areas, and they talk about how it's very difficult for them to describe what they do, given the abstract nature. But I'm getting a sense that, I mean, I think you've done a wonderful job trying to explain your research, but through speaking to you and to other Norian winners who work in applied mathematics, I'm getting the sense that it's actually just as difficult to do that in applied mathematics. You know, you can talk about the applications themselves, but it seems like it's difficult to answer the question, so where is the maths in that?
It is to probably a general audience. That's absolutely. I mean, you know, we're talking about nonlinear partial differential equations with boundary conditions, and what does that even mean for a general audience? So I suppose I'm trying to sort of get the attention or the focus on what comes out of it, even if people don't see all of the sort of working that goes behind it.
I want to bring up something you said earlier, which was how you use certain techniques in a wide variety of applications. And when we looked at your list of publications, it doesn't seem like you focus on one particular area. Like, there are people who are biomathematicians, and there are people who work in financial mathematics. There are people who are mathematical oceanographers, but you seem to find applications in a very broad range of things, like, you know, plants and diseases and fungi and bacteria, but also think you've done a bit of mathematical physics or things related to that. I guess the naive question that I have is it the same thing? Maybe more broadly, don't we have like a small set of tools that we use in all applications? It seems like there's a huge demand for applied mathematicians, right? Like, haven't we figured out the main tools that we need to solve things?
I guess when we solve applied mathematics problems, there's two paths we can take. We can look for an approximate solution. So that's sort of very, you know, computational, where we're trying to numerically approximate a complicated system, or so, you know, we've got some sort of model and then we try to solve it. And I've taken quite a different path. So when I started in my PhD, I was looking at Lee symmetry methods, which is a sort of a pure math idea, but you can use it to find ways to take differential equations and reduce the order of the differential equations. And the idea is that if you can do that, you somehow feel that maybe you've got more chance of solving the reduced equation than the original equation. So I guess what I'm trying to say is a lot of the research I've done, even though the names of the papers or the focus seems different, it's looking for analytic or exact solutions that we can write down, so solutions to these differential equations. And so the technique, which is very powerful, that lies behind all of this is quite similar, and we're doing these classifications of general equations, or like, you know, a general diffusion equation or some of the other things that I've done, and then using that to try to extract some solutions. Now, you can't find necessarily lots of solutions, and so there's always this when you go to applied maths conferences, you always have this disconnect between the people who are doing analytic solutions and people who are saying, well, why don't you just go and, you know, approximate the solution? And the defensive answer is to say, well, you do need some exact solution so you can check if your numerical scheme is reasonable. But the other answer is, which was probably my more personal answer, is actually I really love sort of teasing out and classifying and saying, can I somehow resolve this problem so I can write down an exact solution to it? And is it even possible? And maybe it's not. Maybe we can't do it. Not every equation can be solved analytically. So underlying a lot of the things that I've done is this least symmetry analysis, and I've applied it to lots of different problem areas, but it's fundamentally this coming back to this common technique. But it's the same technique that I'm exploiting quite a lot in many of my papers. But I have done some papers that are quite different. I mean, one of the ones on leaves with the hairs on the leaves, that's nothing to do with anything else that I've done. And that was such a lot of fun. And that was work that I did with Bob Anderson, who is a retired mathematician from CSIRO. And it's about saying, can we replicate something that's observed in nature as a sort of a mutant? So the idea is that if you have a leaf and it has hairs on the leaves, they don't occur in cells next to each other typically. That's the sort of what you would expect to see. But you do see leaves that have all these clumps with lots of hairs all close together. And you're going, how do you replicate what would be considered a mutant? And you're sort of saying, can you come up with some simple rules that you can simulate that behavior? And that was really playful. Like, it was a lot of hard work because I was trying to program this sort of the idea of a leaf using hexagonal cells, and then imposing these different rules to see what sort of different patterns came out. But it was heaps of fun and then really satisfying, because then we came up with some simple rules where we went, we can actually have rules that would help us to recover what we see in mutant types. Anyway, it was fun. I mean, that's the other thing. Sometimes you get stuck in your research, but often there's a great deal of fun and satisfaction when you get a problem out, or you see some sort of breakthrough or some way that you can get past some barrier, and that's great. And the collaboration. I think some people research on their own, but I don't think that many do really. And I think that collaborative bouncing ideas off each other, and sometimes you get a little bit flat because you get quite busy with other things, but that other person gets excited and they pull you along, and it also makes you stay on top of it, and you're always communicating, which is always really important, you know, that communication, constant communication with your peers. You know, I mean, that's terrific. Can't replicate that.
I definitely want to talk about collaboration, because you have collaborated quite a lot. I mean, to finish off that question, so if you found methods that you can use in lots of different areas, then what's different about them? You know, like, why haven't we just published a paper that says, like, the solution to everything, to put very bluntly.
I don't think there is a solution to everything. There's not like a 42 or something. I mean, that's one of the things I think when you speak to people outside mathematics and they're going, well, you're doing a PhD in mathematics, but doesn't everybody already know everything, because they sort of think it's about, I don't know, counting or whatever. And there's always things that are currently being done, and you can look at them and say, well, is there something different that we could do, or why is this particular problem interesting? But it's certainly not all known. And actually, one of the things that we talked about at the start of this, and we were talking about when I gave my presentation in 1993, is the topic that I was doing. So I was just starting out in this sort of least symmetries. I mean, they had been around for a long time, but people had to do all of the work by hand. And then it was at the time that symbolic algebra packages were coming out, and there was also a package developed by James Schering and Jeff Prince that did a lot of this symmetry analysis. It actually kind of did a lot of the analysis for you, because essentially what you're doing is you're solving systems of equations all the time. And so suddenly things that people would have had to do by hand could be done a lot more quickly. And so then at that particular time, there was a lot of interest in it and how all these different areas of symmetry analysis tied together, because there were the classical method and the non-classical method and conditional symmetries. And then suddenly everyone was looking at it, and then you're seeing the connections between the different ideas. And it was really the right time, like, and my supervisor was sort of part of that, I suppose. And it was the right time to be in an area that was very, even though the technique's old, the discussion about it was really contemporary at the time. And so it was really interesting.
One thing that I found quite interesting about your work is, like you mentioned, delay symmetries, right? And that's something that we associate with algebra, right? Or that side of mathematics, if you like. But I've always viewed applied mathematics as something that's insanely calculus heavy, right? Or analysis heavy, or that side of mathematics. And in fact, I'm, you know, maybe slightly ashamed to admit that I ruled out an applied mathematics major because I didn't like calculus so much and thought, maybe that means applied maths isn't for me. Yeah, I just found it interesting that, you know, one of the fundamental objects in your research is actually an algebraic structure.
Yeah. But I probably never think about it in quite that way. I think about it as a tool, in a way, that I use to get insights into differential equations that are generated by interested in some sort of physical problem. So it's a thing that I can use for this sort of more applied sort of outcome, I suppose.
So, you know, we talked about collaboration, and you know, you've collaborated with so many people. And I guess working in so many different types of applications, you kind of have to do that, right? What do you get out of it other than a few extra brains? You
know? Yeah, but collaboration, you do get a few extra brains. But you often have your own strengths and weaknesses. And I guess by collaborating, you form a team that as a whole has a lot of extra skills that maybe you don't have on your own. So some of the work that I've done with Bob Anderson, he's just so curious. He's got all these ideas, and you're going, well, how can we take those ideas and then actually embed them in some mathematics? You know, can we answer some of those questions? And maybe we can't answer all of them. I don't know. And then other times, you might have someone who sort of has that really good physical insights in the modeling, and then someone who's really good at the just kind of digging in and looking for solutions. Or and even if you've got the same set of skills, I think just that working with each other, and it keeps it very fresh. I think if you're on your own doing work, it's very easy to be distracted and to let your research always be last. And so I think having a collaborator also forces you almost to stay engaged with your own research. And I think that's really important. And then you bounce ideas off each other and you have discussions. And sometimes, you know, sometimes the discussion might be rubbish. I mean, maybe nothing comes out of it. And hopefully you're collaborating with people that you, you know, share values with. So you actually enjoy, you know, it's a friendship. It's not just an academic sort of relationship. It's you enjoy catching up with them. And I think especially now, I mean, in the past, I think it was not that easy to collaborate with people who weren't close by, because it's just very hard to get to see them or to communicate. Because now we can communicate electronically, you know, we can be talking to each other and we can see each other. That's a huge help because it makes it more personal. We can exchange documents so easily, you know, we can scan PDFs and send them back and forward. And I mean, I guess one of the things that 2020's shown us is that we can Zoom and we can share screens and we can annotate, and maybe things that I wasn't so aware of in the past. So I think coming out of 2020, which has been not a fun year, we've all been forced to learn some new skills or engage with some new technologies that I actually think are going to be really helpful for us as academics going forward, if we choose to use them.
Yeah, one of my supervisors, like most of his co-authors, he's never met in person, which I find so bizarre.
I mean, often you meet co-authors if you go to conferences and you have work in common. So maybe you've met them once, and then after that you almost it's a correspondence. But at least now it's much easier to correspond, I suppose. But it is, it helps if there's some proximity because then you get to see them. But I think now we can still research or collaborate even if we aren't in the same place.
So how does a collaboration start? Like, does the project find the collaborators or do the collaborators find the project?
I don't know. It's probably a bit of both. I mean, I think sometimes you might be at a conference and someone might say, oh, you know, I was really interested in your work and let me know if you have something that you want to do together. Or my collaboration with Bob Anderson came out of us at Wollongong University running the Australia New Zealand Industrial and Applied Mathematics, Maths and Industry study groups. And we ran those for 3 years where you have industry partners bring in a sort of a research and development sort of problem and then academics and students work on them for the week. And because we were the host of that conference for 3 years, you know, I got to meet a lot of people and Bob came as a moderator and he sort of said to me at the end, you know, if you ever want to do some work together. And then I went on study leave and I thought, well, okay, I might reach out to him. And we just sort of got started on something which we ended up working on quite different things. So sometimes it's not always, you know, what you think you're going to do might not turn out that way. And I guess other times it may be because you already have a particular collaborator that you work with, but then they draw in somebody else and you sort of expand your group of people that you know. I guess people often continue collaborating with their PhD students when they graduate because they obviously have a lot of work in common. So I think it really can vary, depends on the problem and the people you're drawing in.
So you mentioned industry collaboration there. What is it like collaborating with people in industry, say, versus collaborating with other academics?
I guess with those maths and industry study groups, as an academic, you know, you might just choose to look at a particular problem. But with an industry collaborator, then you're trying to, they're sort of articulating a problem and you're trying to take what you understand of what they're saying and model it somehow. So I guess there's a lot of work to be done to say, well, actually, are we answering the question that they're asking? Or is it even maybe the question is their question feasible? You know, is it too complicated? Should we look at as a more fundamental problem, not the super complicated problem? I don't know. And I guess with industry partners, maybe there's also what their expectations are or what they're hoping to get out of it, if there's an investment from them in there. The maths and industry study groups, I think, they would bring a problem and I think most industry partners would go away having gained some insights into the problems that they brought along, but they're not being sold to those study groups, if you know what I mean. Like, it's quite a short amount of time, but I guess what it gives them is a pathway that they can then follow or maybe follow up with more collaboration to continue to answer.
I mean, are the types of problems that they face different from the types of problems that you would work on in academia? I mean, I guess some people imagine, like including me, that the types of problems you choose to pursue in applied mathematics are inspired or motivated by what's going on out there in the world, right? So how are the problems different?
This is just me saying this. I'm not speaking for every applied mathematician. I'd like to put that out there. I think if it's a problem that you're working on yourself, it's probably an idealized problem. So it may not be something that you can take and immediately fit with an industry problem. You know, for example, some of the things that I've done, they're out of interest, but, you know, they're not necessarily being compared to experimental data or anything like that. They're just investigating some ideas. Whereas I think industry will come with very particular problems, you know, slumping of coils of metal or all sorts of things. I mean, sort of agricultural problems where you're sort of spraying and you're saying how much of the spray stays on the leaf of a plant, you know, so you want to know if the spray is going to drip off or if it's going to remain where it's meant to be. I mean, some of those are really very particular problems that I don't think as an academic you would necessarily be coming up with that problem on your own. But, I mean, the Maths and Industry Study Group were really good to see just the variety of types of problems that are out there in industry and that they're willing to bring to get sort of more insights into.
Yeah, I guess when I was an undergraduate, I always had this impression of pure mathematicians, you know, explore ideas for its own sake or out of interest, and applied mathematicians solve real-world problems, right? But I guess from what you said, that's not exactly true and the boundaries are blurred in a sense. Yeah, I find that quite interesting.
Certainly for me, I think they're blurred. I think I'm I'm not in the middle. I'm more towards the applied, but I'm not, I wouldn't say I was a hardcore applied mathematician, for example. Okay, and there's a spectrum, isn't there? So, and that's what makes it kind of interesting, I suppose.
So what is a hardcore applied mathematician like then?
Well, maybe there's someone that actually modeling, you know, a problem and they're just solving it, not sorry, just, that's makes it sound trivial and it's absolutely not, but they are solving it numerically, but they're imposing lots of boundary and initial conditions, and then they're comparing that to, you know, actual real data. And, I mean, part of the problem might be working out what the parameters of the problem are and so on. So they would be at that end where they're actually trying to model and replicate information that's coming from industry or whatever the particular problem is. It doesn't have to be an industrial problem, of course. Or people giving, you know, who are able to advise industry on things that they can do because they understand that really very fundamental problem and then what they could do to improve outputs or whatever it is that the problem happens to be. I don't put myself up at that end of the spectrum, for sure.
Now, you were supervised by Professor Philip Broadbridge. He's a very prominent figure in the mathematics community in Australia. He was the president of ANSIAM at some point. He was the director of AMSI at some point, and AMSI is the Australian Mathematical Sciences Institute. He was head of school at La Trobe University's mathematics department at some point, and he's published prolifically and worked in so many areas. I'm curious to know what it was like working with him, not just during your PhD, but because you collaborated with him a lot even after that.
Yeah, it was great. And that's another one of those, I guess most people, you know, it's that combination of the time and the place and the opportunities that you have. And when I was doing my honours at UOW, so University of Wollongong, Phil arrived that year. And so he taught me in my honours year. And so then I started with him as my supervisor in my PhD. And that was, I think, really good fortune on my part. He had enormous depth of knowledge across a huge range of topics, you know, I think, you know, from physics through to mathematics. He also had been really actively engaged with Jeff Prince and James Shearing when they were developing this symmetry package. So he knew about things as they were just getting started. And so we were sort of, you know, I had access to that package while it probably was in its developmental phase. He's very well respected, knew a lot of people. So you got to meet lots of people through him. And I think that's really valuable when you're a PhD or a young academic, those contacts or the networks that your supervisor had, and that respect that I think also he had in the applied maths community. He could be very intense. And so there were times when you went to meetings and you're like, I haven't really got very much to say this week. And it's quite tricky because some weeks you just don't actually make all that much progress. And other weeks you make a huge amount of progress. And afterwards you go, I should have only told him about half of it. I should have kept the other half for the week after. But you'd be so excited to show him what you did. You'd be going, oh, look at all of this. You know, I've done this big classification. And you'd be laying it all out and you're going, should have waited. And even, I have to say, in my first year of my PhD, we were looking at some ideas that were really fresh and we were trying to sort of using this so-called direct method, which was something that Peter Clarkson had come up with, and we were trying to apply it to our problem. And, you know, everything we did just didn't work and I just think it was never going to work. And sooner or later we had to decide that we would just leave that be. And I have to say that both of us persevered and didn't lose confidence in the fact that we would move on to something that worked. But it's that, and that's actually a really interesting point about academia is when you look at publications are about outcomes, like things that worked, but no one ever tells you about the things that didn't work. And so it'd be interesting to know how many people try to do the same problem over because no one's actually published to say, actually, this didn't work. Anyway. But no, Phil was really, really good. And I think as, you know, as you went through your PhD, you kind of got given a lot more responsibility and, you know, then you become a little bit more independent. But at the start, you know, you need a lot of guidance and, you know, writing papers and things, you would write them together. And as you went along, then you start writing them more on your own. But I remember Phil saying to me one time, oh, I really like this draft, you know, that's probably how I would write it. And I was thinking, yeah, because I'm essentially your apprentice, and of course I kind of semi-adopt your style. So of course I've got a style that's evolved from your style. But no, it was very good. And then partway along through my PhD, I actually started teaching full time, and then I really slowed down on my research, and that was quite not difficult but painful. And I think having a supervisor that's understanding of that is really helpful too, and not just giving up on you, but going, you know, you will get it done, but sometimes it's hard to balance all the different demands that you have on your time. And obviously I did get it done, but it took a lot longer than I would have taken if I had done it full time.
Another interesting thing you mentioned is that often we don't publish the things that didn't work. And when I speak to people in other disciplines, one of the interesting things that we discuss is how in other disciplines, you can publish null results. Like, we did this experiment and turns out we didn't prove our hypothesis, and you can still publish that. But I find, you know, like in my experience as a PhD student, if you don't prove this, you can't publish it. You can't go, I didn't prove it. Why do you think that is? And do you think that's rightfully so? Or do you think that's something that needs to change?
I don't know, but I guess if you said I didn't prove this, it doesn't mean maybe that it can't be proved. But I suppose what it would tell people is that I tried this path to proving it and this didn't work, or, you know, there's need to think about it differently. Yeah, it's true, because you're going, sometimes you wonder, well, who else has done the same thing? You know, am I working on something that someone else has already looked at and they've already decided that it's, you know, not going to be fruitful? Just don't know. I mean, for a pure mathematician, you're looking for a completed proof, right? You're looking for something that's there. And I guess for, you know, maybe with more applied mathematician, you want to say that you found a solution, or you've got an approximation to a solution, or whatever the problem is. So you don't say, oh, I looked here, but it didn't work. But I think it would be valuable. I don't know how it would work. But I think also it's helpful to, and this is maybe more for students as well, to say not everything does work. Because I think with mathematics, for sort of undergraduates and so on, they always think everything has a solution. You know, the things that they're being exposed to, we do know how to prove, or they do have solutions. And so they just think that everything's got a solution. And actually, that's just not true. I mean, even in fundamental things like integration, and we teach all these techniques of integration, but we're only giving them a very small subset of questions that actually do have solutions. We're not going to give them a question that can't be solved, because clearly they won't be able to do that. I think it's a revelation to them to go, you know, we can just vary this question the tiniest bit and you can't solve it. Like, it doesn't have a solution that we can write down. But I'm not sure we're going to be encouraged to publish null results anytime soon, like, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I guess conversely, it's also what I've experienced in my PhD is you also don't know if no one's ever tried it. Like, sometimes I'll ask my supervisor, you know, like, this problem has been open for 30 years. Why do you think I'm going to solve it, like, of all people? And then he'll just go, like, because no one's tried it before. And like, how do you know that?
Know that?
Like,
yeah.
And it's like, well, because I happen to talk to everyone who works in this area, right? But, you know, I guess I'm lucky that I have a supervisor who talks to every single person in the world who does this thing.
Well, I guess that's about confidence in knowing what exists already. Like, and that's not about collaboration, but that whole thing about communication, isn't it? And being current and knowing, well, what people are doing and sharing ideas. And I think it's really good to share your ideas and not be suspicious that someone's going to, I don't know, pinch it, but to share ideas so that we're all sort of moving forward in a really resourceful sort of way.
You talked about balancing teaching versus research. I mean, you've had a long academic career and you've probably taught countless lectures. And even for me as a PhD student who does some teaching on the side, I know that sometimes it's difficult to balance. What is that like for you, and how do you try to balance that?
Well, I don't think I have a balance, to be honest. And so I think when I'm teaching, I find teaching quite consuming, and I really want to do a good job, and I really want to get students involved, and I really, you know, am prepared to give a lot of time to supporting students. And so often, that, you know, when you're in that mindset, it's hard to switch back to thinking about research, which is, I think, where collaborators are really important, because they keep you kind of the thread of the ideas going along, and you'll all have your own ups and downs, but at least that thread's always there. But I have to say, after I got my 25 years, you know, service award, so 25 years teaching last year, and I still don't think I have a better balance than I did, you know, 20 years ago. But everybody's different. So, and it depends what their main focus is. And I guess I really enjoy teaching and I really enjoy interacting with students. And so to me, that's not a chore anyway. I think as an academic, when we get to go on study leave, so we have sabbatical's just really important because it gives you that moment, which is maybe six months, not a moment, but it gives you that break from all of your other duties where you're allowed to only think about research, and it just absolutely refreshes your research that hopefully then that will sustain you for the next, you know, couple of years until you get your next sabbatical. So that's, I think, a really important part of, well, the academic sort of life that we've had at UOW and most other academics do as well. And when you come out of your sabbatical, you're quite refreshed and the research is still sort of front of mind, but the longer you get from your sabbatical, the it sort of declines, I find. But other people are quite different to me. But it is a tricky balance. And then it's not the only, I mean, academics don't just do teaching and research, they also have governance. And so it's those sort of three strands of sort of trying to manage all of them at the same time and do a good job in all of them, or maybe focus on two out of the three. It depends on what your particular focus is.
One phrase that I hear a lot amongst academics is that research can always wait, but teaching can't.
Well, unfortunately, that's true. And then that probably does end up happening because it's never got such an immediate deadline as, well, I've got to get this marking done by tomorrow, or I haven't written my exam yet or something. Teaching often has very immediate deadlines that you cannot put off. You have to address them.
I think one phrase that gets thrown around a lot with mathematics communication and outreach is that mathematics is all around us. I think even to, say, high school students or people who haven't engaged with maths much, that means something to them, and yet it also doesn't at the same time. What does that phrase mean to you, that phrase that mathematics is all around us?
I think as mathematicians, we do see that mathematics is around us because we're looking at things differently. And I guess it's trying to communicate that to, you know, just school kids or the general public that they can, you know, how you can see the mathematics within a certain area of their life. And that mathematics isn't just about maybe numbers or, I don't know, or sort of false problem-solving sort of things that are just made up, that there are genuine things around them that they can see. And I think a lot of people have an interest in that those general ideas, but maybe their background doesn't let them kind of, I mean, a lot of people will say that they were never good at mathematics, which I feel quite compelled to tell you. I'm not sure why. I'm actually pretty bad at spelling, but apparently that doesn't get me any concession. So I think it's really important for us to be able to try to engage everybody to say, well, actually, you know, there are all these things that you can appreciate with mathematics if you look at them a little bit differently, which is quite nice.
I think, like, if you look at a lot of the maths outreach there, some common examples that people give are like fractals, you know, like lots of fractals around us, or golden ratio and things like that. What do you think of, like, personally for you, what comes to mind when we say mathematics is all around us?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, fractals, I mean, you can find lots of examples in nature, and they're also very beautiful. So they're, it's an easy thing to engage people with. But even things like, you know, we've done sessions with primary school children playing with Möbius strips, and just, I mean, they don't necessarily get any mathematics, but it's that idea of discovery, you know, and you're just going, well, you just do something really simple and you just twist it and then you do these things and you cut it in half and, oh, what's going to happen? And then they go, oh, was that mathematics? So we go, sort of, but, you know, nothing that you write down in a way. So, I don't know, just having lots of playful things that people can do to appreciate mathematics, I think, would be so valuable. But it's not always easy to do.
One thing that I've sort of wondered is mathematics is, like, to some extent, a human construct, right? I mean, I don't want to open up the can of worms of is mathematics invented or discovered, right? But to some extent, you know, it's like we made this up, right? And yet it seems to be so good at modeling or describing naturally occurring things in the world. Why is that so? Like, why is something so that can be so artificial be so rich to describe real-world situations?
I don't know how to answer that. I mean, one of the things I would say to that is that I was talking about the leaf with hairs on it before, and it's sort of saying that when the leaf's growing, it doesn't know about really complicated mathematical rules. And so one of the ideas, I suppose, when we were looking at that is it's saying we should be able to, or we should, that's a strong word, we would like to be able to see if we could say, can we find some simple sort of rules that we can apply that we can get this kind of mutant behaviour where we have clumps of hairs all next to each other, and sort of saying, let's not try to come up with a really complicated solution. It shouldn't need to be complicated. You know, it should be simplistic in a way. And there's been some nice other mathematics done on pea leaves and mutant pea leaves and really simple ideas of switching and why it's mutant or not mutant. And those ideas I think are really lovely because you're not looking for a really complicated answer. You're saying, well, the plant doesn't know about a complicated mathematics, right? It just decides I'm either going to do this or I'm going to do this. It's some simple reason why it switches between different states. So that's using quite uncomplicated mathematics, but it doesn't mean that it's easy to come up with, like to understand what you need to do. That's a different question.
One thing that you said that I've sort of never really thought about is like, yeah, the leaf doesn't know complicated mathematics. Like when we describe these real world phenomena or how they work from a mathematics perspective, it's simple and complicated at the same time. Yeah, I guess like a lot of people's perceptions of mathematics, including myself, is that at the level that we work at as research mathematicians, we're like PhD and above, you know, it's all the hardcore complicated equations that no one understands. But yeah, you're right. It's hard to just to explain.
But that's what makes mathematics fun, right? The idea that maybe you try and look at something complicated and maybe, or simple maybe makes it sound like it's not worthwhile. It is worthwhile, but maybe it's a, trying to think, it's not necessarily like with the leaf problem, I wouldn't say it was elegant or anything, but you're just going, once we sort of came up with the idea, we went, oh, that just seems so obvious now that we've said it, right? Oh, yeah, that works. But beforehand, that was a real barrier. So sometimes when you actually see what to do, you're going, well, doesn't seem like that was such a difficult solution to arrive at. But you had to change the way you thought about it or something, you know, that I guess that's what makes elements of mathematics so lovely. And I mean, a lot of students would say this at school too. They like mathematics. Well, they say because they always get a right answer. But I think that sense of satisfaction of resolving a problem, whether it's a school problem or, you know, you're a researcher, that's enormously satisfying. And, yeah, I really love that.
Your research has spanned many decades. I mean, you're one of the earliest Norman winners and among the very first Norman winners who work in, again, in inverted commas, applied mathematics, right? Or closer to that end of the spectrum. How has the way we apply mathematics changed over the years?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think in the sorts of some of the research that I've been looking at, I'm still using some of the fundamental ideas that I was using in my PhD. So maybe I just haven't evolved very much. I'm not sure. The problems are changing, or you're looking at different problems and then you're asking, can I use this set of tools or techniques that I've got behind me? Because that's one of my strengths. Can I use that on a new problem or a new area? So I guess sometimes you're looking at what you know that you have strengths in and saying, well, how does that apply to new problems? I'm sure there's lots of other things happening out there that I'm not really across. And I have to say one of the things I've been a little bit tardy on is not attending lots and lots of conferences. So I don't get to see everything that's going on. Like I don't get to go to the OSTMS annual conference or the ANSIAM conferences often. And you made a really good point about that at the very start when you were saying the fact that these conferences move around. I mean, they move around, I suppose, for two reasons. One is because then every institution takes the turn at being the host, so the effort is shared. But the other really important point which you made was that moving around Australia and the ANSIAM meetings also go to New Zealand is that it gives different sets of people opportunities to travel to different conferences, whereas maybe sometimes you can't afford to go to Western Australia, but if it's in Sydney or Newcastle or Canberra, you know, if you're on the eastern seaboard of Australia, then you can go to that with not a great deal of expense. And it just means that different groups go each year so that everyone gets an opportunity, hopefully at some stage, for it to be somewhere close to them. Anyway, but that was a long way of saying I haven't actually been super active in going to conferences. And I think that's also, I guess I've been a bit more teaching focused. And so sometimes it's easy to say, oh, well, I'm not going to go to that conference. So I have gone to some that are closer by, but I haven't actually traveled as much more recently.
The thing I find interesting about your answer is what you didn't say, which I think most people think you would say is about computers. I mean, I feel like most people's perception is that that's the one thing that's changed everything.
I think when I was coming into my PhD, that was changing then, and that's been a constant all the way through. So certainly that opened up the whole area that I sort of did my PhD in, and I was in that. I was kind of part of that way at the time. Because I think before that, it was just so arduous to do all of that work by hand. You know, we're talking about all this symbolic algebra. It just would have been incredibly tedious. So that was actually changing as I was starting. And so I guess as you develop, you're just drawing in these new technologies and, you know, they just become part of your toolkit of things that you can jump over here and use this thing to check something or investigate something somewhere else. Now, you're right. I mean, I think that's certainly true. I mean, even, I know it sounds funny, but even as a student, we would have had a Unix account with an email account, you know, nothing like what people talk about now. Like it was, you know, really very, everything was incredibly clunky and you're using editors and like everything. You couldn't even imagine, like if you took an undergraduate student and showed them what you used to do, they'd be looking at you like, really? So yes, I think technology has just enormously changed everything.
But at the same time, you mentioned that like they're still the same ideas that are prevailing.
Well, fundamentally, you still have to do similar things. Maybe you just have a few more tools that you can use. But I mean, fundamentally, it's always about thinking, isn't it? I mean, they might aid you to do some things, but it's still about the insights that you have or the way you decide to tackle a problem or what problem you take on, or that's not really changing.
I like to ask you the question that we ask all of our guests at the end, which is to complete the sentence, a mathematician is someone who?
I think a mathematician is someone who is always trying to understand what's going on. And if I look at, I think I'm modelling this on my collaboration with Bob Anderson, who would have been an incredibly curious child, and now he's a curious retired mathematician. And everything is about, but why? And he looks at every problem and he's thinking, but why does it do that thing? And how can I predict that? Or that's the long answer to your question. But I think a mathematician is someone who's always kind of trying to look below the surface to understand what's behind a problem or a phenomena. And they're always curious and querying what's going on.
Many thanks to Maureen for talking to us for this episode. We put a link to Maureen's webpage in the show notes. This episode was produced by Alina Sari and myself. Thanks also to Chris Rock for helping us with this episode. We'll be back soon with another interview. Neumann Talk is a podcast produced by students and staff from the School of Mathematics and Statistics at UNSW Sydney and hosted by me, Yudi Bunyamin. Follow UNSW Maths and Stats on Facebook or Instagram to see updates on the latest episodes as well as other exciting news from our school. If you've been listening to our podcast, then we'd love to hear from you. Send me a tweet or a message on Twitter at @Yudi_Bunyamin. Let us know who you are and if there's something one of the winners talked about that really resonated with you, or even if you have any questions about mathematics of your own.